far as the attorneys know, expecting Central Wisconsin Christian School to be attending, and we are expecting about 37 students, but they have not yet arrived. So I will advise you all and advise those who are listening to the session on Wisconsin I or on the court streaming our oral argument that these students are coming to the court with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. The students across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if the invitation is accepted, the students are given materials about the case that they will hear. They listen to the oral argument, and then they meet with a justice assigned for the day to meet with the students at about noon. Everyone is invited to the session. You all, as lawyers and anyone in the audience, may come. The discussion with the students centers on the procedures of the court in taking and deciding cases, not the substantive issues in the case. With that said, I'm sorry if their movement in the court will disturb you, but if you hear rustling, that's the students. Let me call the first case, 09-AP-2176, Dawn L. Maxwell versus Hartford Union High School District. Arguing for the Community Insurance Cooperation is Lori M. Lubinsky. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. As you indicated, my name is Lori Lubinsky. I work at the law firm of Axley Brennelson, and I represent Community Insurance Corporation in this lawsuit. This case is about a unique issue brought to the court. I want to first address what it's not about, so we dispel any notion that certain insurance issues that kind of percolate through our jurisprudence, we can dispel the notion that those are issues in this case. This is not a duty to defend case. It's not a case over interpretation of an insurance policy. It's not a case involving whether a policy provision is ambiguous or not. It really rests on a simple concept that has implications, and the concept is this: whether an insurer can create coverage under a policy where none otherwise exists by furnishing a defense but yet not issuing a reservation of rights letter.
Counsel, does the record reflect, and obviously I wouldn't want you to go beyond the record, but certainly the thought occurs, why wasn't the reservation of rights letter sent? Does the record reflect that reason?
It does not reflect that reason. It simply reflects that none was sent.
Counselor, the pleadings that were filed, as I look at them and they start out, were not filed as a direct action against the insurance company. So there wasn't any allegation in the initial complaint that said there was coverage, correct?
That's correct.
Does that have anything to do with the argument that you put forth today on why no reservation of rights letter was sent before defense was undertaken?
It does in a kind of peripheral sense. The fact that there was no allegation of coverage obviously meant that the insurance company wasn't a party. And because the insurance company wasn't a party, no attorney appeared for an insurance company until the merits of the case reached a point where the trial court had rendered a decision partially disposing of the case and rendering a partial sum of money to Ms. Maxwell. The issue of whether the insurer was brought under the direct action statute was never an issue. And so the record is devoid of any indication of why Ms. Maxwell did not bring a direct action or not. But clearly there was no insurance counsel representing Community Insurance Corporation, my client, until it was named in the lawsuit. I will kind of tangentially address that question with a little more facts. The Maxwell complaint and any amendment thereto pled, in essence, claims that did have coverage under the policy. This insurance policy does pay for attorney's fees. It also pays for compensatory damages. It has a clear exclusion. I believe it's not in dispute that that exclusion precludes coverage for wage loss. So what we had is we had a situation where there – community insurance had a situation where there was a complaint that gave rise to arguable coverage. And as we all know, if some of it's covered and some of it's not, the duty to defend exists as to all. Community insurance hired counsel to represent the insured and did – and then that lawsuit percolated for a couple of years. Only after the adverse ruling did the district's general counsel attorney Moore notify community insurance that the district expected the insurance company to foot the bill for damages that were clearly barred by the exclusion. And that, I think, also addresses your question, Justice, by indicating that there was no indication at any point until that communication that the insured was perhaps under a mistaken belief that there was coverage where none existed. There is no allegation in this case that there was an affirmative representation of coverage, and that should be clear. The allegation is an omission. It is, hey, if you would have given us a reservation of rights letter, we would have seen what's already in the policy, and somehow that would have changed the way we approach the litigation. That's the allegation, and that your failure to do that should render you to not be able to rely on that provision. Your Honor, I will continue on with my argument. I assume Justice, you don't want to stop.
We are not stopping, but Justice Bradley had a question.
Yes.
Thank you. You started your argument as to what this case was not, which is, in my mind, a good way to start. It reminds me of a case that I pulled in preparation for this case today. And it's a case written by former Justice Steinmetz on an insurance issue. And it's the case of Town Realty versus Zurich Insurance. And I don't expect you to necessarily pull that case out of your hat, but suffice it to say, it involved a duty to defend in whether or not the letter sent by the insured to the insurer was clear enough that was tendering the defense, and that was the general issue. And former Justice Steinmetz in paragraph 4 noted, okay, this involves a duty to defend, and this court has repeatedly held that if there's any doubt about the duty to defend, it must be resolved in favor of the insurer. And you started saying this is not a duty to defend case. And then he goes on to say, you know, and when there's ambiguity, it's resolved in favor of the insurer. And you started with your preface, this isn't about an ambiguous policy. But then he says this. Underlying these decisions, that is, regarding duty to defend and ambiguity, is the general realization that the insurer is in a superior position to the insured in relation to the formation and interpretation of the insurance contract. And therefore, we hold, if it's unclear or ambiguous, you know, insurance company must take the rowing oar. It says this, in quoting, this places the burden of ensuring clear communication between the insurer and insured on the insurer, who is better positioned in terms of expertise and resources to manage such a task. Why shouldn't that, under what he talks about, a general realization of an underlying premise, that when the burden of ensuring clear communication between the insurer and insured is on the insurance company because it is in a position which is better in terms of expertise and resources to manage the task. Why shouldn't that apply here?
First of all, that case clearly by – I'm unfamiliar with that case,
yes,
but I appreciate Your Honor's point that this is what the case was about. Obviously, that case was about an ambiguous letter from an insured, it sounds like.
That's exactly what it was
There's
about.
Absolutely no application of that case to this case. There's nothing ambiguous about anything. There's no claim here that the policy is ambiguous. But to your point about why doesn't that matter, the communications that were apparently at issue in that case involved a communication from an insured asking for defense.
I know this doesn't involve the duty to defend, and I know that there's not an argument regarding ambiguity. My question goes to his general premise that underlies these cases, and that is, look, if there is, for some reason, not clear communication between the insured and the insurer, we place the burden of going forward. And in this case, indeed, in Zurich, it was the insurance company. Then, if there's some uncertainty, Justice Steinmetz and the rest of the court, it's unanimous opinion, said it's the burden of the insurance company to contact the insured to see if what they were really doing in that letter was tendering the defense to us. But why doesn't that premise hold true here? If there is a lack of communication, the burden of ensuring clear communication between the two falls better on the insurance company because of expertise and resources. It appears to me there's a lack of communication here.
There's not a lack of communication.
Okay. Fair enough.
The communication is in the policy. The policy says what it says, and they don't dispute it says what it says. And they got it no less than five different times. This
isn't
is not any – I'm sorry.
No.
Go ahead.
Please finish.
Okay. Clearly what was at issue in that case, without having read it, is some sort of ambiguous letter. And the court's framework, and Justice Steinmetz's framework for dealing with that poor communication, was to say, okay, here's something ambiguous. Insure, it's your burden. Your burden to clarify something ambiguous. There's nothing ambiguous in this case.
One final comment, then. Isn't there a lack of communication with regard to a reservation of rights and whether or not that's asserted and when it's asserted? Maybe I'm missing something.
We concede that there was no reservation of rights letter. That doesn't mean, however, that there is a lack of communication.
Counsel?
What it,
are you done with the answer to Justice Bradley? I don't want to interrupt. Okay, I just wonder. If you would have issued a reservation of rights letter, you wouldn't be here today. Is that fair enough to say?
I think that it's fair enough to say that the claims that are being made against community insurance would not bring us here today. Okay. We may be here on other matters, but this technical issue would not be present.
In your view, if you would have issued a proper letter reserving your rights, what would that letter say?
The letter would tell the insured, you've been sued in a lawsuit by Ms. Maxwell. Here's what Ms. Maxwell's allegations are, A, B, C, D. You have an insurance policy. As you know, that policy provides certain coverage. It would outline the coverage provided. It would, in all likelihood, at the end, tell Ms. Maxwell, we've hired counsel to represent you. His name is such and such. You can make contact with him, something along those lines.
Would it specifically say, this claim you have coverage for, this claim you don't have coverage for, this claim you have coverage for, this claim is unclear?
No. Typically, what reservation of rights letters that I see are is to notify the insured that there's a lawsuit, that they're picking up the defense, that there are issues with respect to coverage, and they outline what the coverage terms are, perhaps block quoting an exclusion, maybe highlighting something else important, and then advising the insured that counsel has been retained. And let me further that thought in one respect, and that is this. If the court is going to adopt some new bright-line rule, contrary to established precedent, that estoppel and waiver can invoke coverage where none exists based on a failure to send a reservation of rights letter, then we have the related issue which flows from your question, Justice, and that is, what difference? What's the harm? What does that do? And the underlying premise, I think, in the Court of Appeals decision and the arguments, I think, that are being brought out are, well, if you would have issued a reservation of rights letter, then we wouldn't have lost the case. And with due respect, that's a matter for the trial court. The issue of what would have happened and what whether the result in this case had anything to do with the counsel that was hired by the insurance company is a factual matter for the trial court to resolve.
Are you aware of the case of Powell's versus Cheesemakers?
Yes, I am. And we addressed that in our brief.
Yeah, my understanding of that case is that the holding was that the insurer was precluded from using a coverage defense because it assumed the defense, defended the action through judgment, and did not reserve its rights or disclaim coverage. And some of the key language is the insurance company, by its conduct, waived its right to assert the policy defense of non-coverage. How do you get around that case?
This court in the Shannon case said that the very language, Justice, you're using was dicta. Powell's was a reformation case.
We have a rule here, at least we often invoke, that anything said by the Wisconsin Supreme Court is not dicta.
Okay,
so let me add that to the
file. Sure, I understand that. I can also tell, Your Honor, that in the Shannon case, this court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, said, quote, nowhere in Powell's is there a discussion of the issue of whether an exclusion in a policy can be waived. The court in Shannon, this court, said that Powell's was a reformation case. And if you look at Powell's and if you read it, I'm confident you will agree that what the court was addressing in Powell's was reformation. Not addressing waiver.
Wasn't Powell's where the owner of the business had his personal automobile, a Buick automobile, and he, during the telephone conversation with the insurance agent, made the agreement that as long as he was getting the business insured, that the Buick, his own personal motor vehicle, would also be insured. And I don't believe there was any dispute about that. The insurance agent and the company did not dispute that. They said, yes, that was the deal that was struck. And so, therefore, when the owner of the cheese factory got in an accident in the Buick, they simply said it was a scrivener's error or a clerical error that omitted that part of their agreement from the contract that was issued.
And that's exactly what happened in Powell's. Those are the facts of Powell's. The holding of Powell's is that the court reformed it based on those facts. And so there is this statement. You're right. There's a statement after the holding that is one sentence that talks about waiver. And I guess the only way I can respond, I understand this court's ruling with regard to the ability to look at all parts of our prior your prior decisions. But this court has addressed that in Shannon and said that wasn't an analysis of waiver.
If we were to look at what's happening nationally in other jurisdictions, would it be fair to say that other jurisdictions seem to be moving in the direction of the Powell's case?
I think it would be fair to say that there are several jurisdictions that have estoppel and waiver to create coverage. In other words, that recognize those claims for creating coverage. However, I would point out that those jurisdictions in which they do recognize that, in our research, we've concluded that in those jurisdictions, the court also analyzes the elements of waiver and estoppel. And the elements of waiver and estoppel clearly, we've got this in our brief, but clearly require an analysis of what impact or what import it had for the failure to issue a reservation of rights letter. And in some of those cases outside Wisconsin where they recognize the tort, they in turn say, but there's no, they either affirm or in some respects say the trial court got it right when the trial court analyzed the elements of waiver and estoppel and dismissed the claim. That didn't happen in this case because the Court of Appeals basically adopted the new rule as referenced in the jurisprudence outside the state of Wisconsin and then said, as a matter of law, we're always going to assume prejudice. There's no fact inquiry. There's no further analysis that needs to be employed. I believe that if you look at and we've cited this in our briefs, the decisions from outside Wisconsin, the vast majority of those courts that do have this claim available then require an analysis. It's not just assumed. And in fact, it would be contrary to Wisconsin law to assume prejudice.
Well, you can say there's prejudice per se so that we don't have to deal with every particular case. That's one way of treating it, isn't it?
It is.
You can say that there's a presumption of prejudice and then one party or the other has to rebut it, right?
That would be another way.
That's right. And probably if we sat around, we could think of several other ways of dealing with this. And I assume that what you just said goes to the to your brief where you ask for a remand should the court adopt a rule that you can waive your defense of coverage, of lack of coverage, right?
Okay. That's exactly it.
I just want to go back and see if I can understand something. Apparently, this policy covered something that related to the underlying claim, right?
Yes.
But not other things.
Yes.
So what did, and I think that's important. What did it cover and what didn't it cover? Because, and then what should, if you had a perfect world and counsel were perfect, what would the reservation say? Because here, you can't reserve that there's no coverage because there is coverage, right? You can see there's coverage for
yes.
something. Okay. So what's covered and what's not covered?
The complaint raised, let's just talk remedies. I think that's the easiest way to look at it. The complaint asserted a claim for attorney's fees. That would be covered. The complaint asserted wage loss benefit loss and kind of 401k, those sorts of things, that's not covered. The complaint also asserted very general allegations of consequential damages. Moving expenses would be one example that I believe is being claimed by Don Maxwell. That's covered. So I believe that answers the first part of your question.
Well, so I gather from your answer that you are liable, that the insurance company is liable if the breach of contract existed. Is that right?
It's liable for the damages that are covered if the breach of contract
okay.
existed.
So what damages were covered?
The damages that, well, first of all, Don Maxwell's request for attorney's fees were denied by the trial court.
But what under your policy, in a breach of contract case on employment, what's covered? Attorney fees not. Wage loss is generally a damage in a breach of contract in employment.
It is. There is a specific exclusion addressing wage loss.
So what does your policy cover?
It covers consequential damages.
What were claimed here that was covered by this policy?
Attorney's fees, moving expenses. I'm sorry, Your Honor,
none of them
I don't understand
were,
your
not,
question.
You say none of them are covered. I want to know what you covered. What did you pay?
We haven't paid anything because, Your Honor.
Okay. What can you possibly pay?
Based on the trial court's ruling, the only outstanding, it has not yet been determined, amount that would be covered would be moving expenses. The court denied the attorney's fees request. That may go up on appeal. If it's reversed, we would have coverage for it.
You do you do allow coverage?
Yes.
For return.
Oh,
that's
yes.
What,
I
what
misspoke,
about wage loss?
Wage loss and benefit loss is not covered.
Okay, but attorney fees are covered.
Yes, they
okay.
are.
Okay.
I apologize.
Wage loss is not covered. That's what I am. Consequential damages, are they covered?
They are. Covered. Moving expenses, okay. In the like.
So what I hear you telling me is that the liability issue, which is that the only issue in the case? You're liable to this employee for breach of contract, that's covered by the policy, and what you're only fighting about is how much damages are covered by the policy. Is that the issue?
That's the only thing this fight is about. In due respect to Ms. Maxwell, there are other fights that still remain for her claims. But because the trial court...
Are you fighting coverage on those?
There is defense being offered for those claims. The
are
claims
you fighting
that are
coverage on anything else?
When you say coverage, I understand that to mean defense and indemnity. The indemnity aspect...
We're in an indemnity case.
Okay.
And your brief carefully points out this is not a duty to defend case.
Okay. All right. On indemnification, we are not fighting anything other than in this dispute that's before you, which is whether the policy creates coverage for wage loss and benefits, where none exists.
Counsel,
that's
oh, were you finished?
I was. Thank you.
I have a question that runs to a rather basic part of this case. And I start with the observation of the Court of Appeals opinion written by Judge Anderson. where he says at paragraph 14, what constitutes a sufficient reservation of rights letter has not been addressed in Wisconsin, but then he goes on to talk about couch on insurance and what basically has been described as an adequate reservation of rights letter. My question is a basic one, and it is, where does the duty to issue a reservation of rights letter come from? And where is that? Is that in a contract? Is that in a case?
It flows from, it's in a case. It's not, there is a duty to defend under the contract.
Right.
The insurance policy does say we will defend you for
understand that.
The legal kind of implication of duty to defend comes from the Grub v. Don line of cases in which the court said if you contest your duty to defend.
Right. If you contest, that's
correct.
It.
Correct. And I'm aware of no Wisconsin case.
That's at, well, it's page 11 off the Lexis printout. The issue in Grub, the instant case, whether an insurer who breached its duty to defend can later contest coverage. Okay. But in this instance, I'm wondering, we're all talking about the reservation of rights letter, but the thought certainly occurs, where does that duty come from?
Well, I concur, Your Honor, and I will have to say that's why Community Insurance didn't issue a reservation of rights letter. I don't want to go beyond the record, but the state of the law at the time this was tendered, there is no Wisconsin case that said they were somehow obligated to issue a reservation of rights letter when they fully embraced their duty to defend, and there's no claim there was a breach here, and simply that they had a policy provision that would not cover some of the damages. It's akin to any standard. I do a lot of insurance defense, and I get a lot of assignments from insurance companies, and I know, just because I'm a lawyer and I do this, that there are lots of provisions in a policy that could arguably point out that there'd be no coverage. One is easy, a policy limit.
So are you saying that when the insurance company defends, they have no obligation to send a reservation of rights letter?
It is our position that under the current state of law, the answer to your question is yes, they have no obligation unless they contest their duty to defend.
And is the converse true, that if you don't defend, then you do send a reservation of rights letter? That makes no sense to me.
No, the converse is not true. The converse is if you contest your duty to defend, then you must send a reservation of rights letter. And that's the converse as I see it.
That's the only time. When you go ahead and defend, but you contest your duty to defend, then you must send a reservation of rights letter.
Correct. That is how our view of the case is. I see my time is up. May I briefly finish my answer?
Yes, you may, counsel.
Thank you. That is the Grub v. Don line of cases that was relied on by the Court of Appeals to create this duty in a duty to indemnify context. All of those cases are duty to defend, and those cases hold exactly that. If you contest your duty to defend, then you must send a reservation of rights letter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney James W. Moore, Jr., representing Hartford Union High School District and Board of Education.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. It's good
morning.
To be back. My name is Jim Moore, and I represent the people down at the Hartford Union High School District and their Board of Education. I want to begin by observing that when I'm in front of this court, it's usually always representing an insurance company, so I feel a little uncomfortable here taking on a case against an insurance company.
Oh, that's one of the change sides, counsel?
I'm sorry?
Do you want to change sides? Not today.
Occasionally in my career, I've had to be a plaintiff's lawyer, and I almost have to ask the judge, where do I sit, because I have no idea where a defense lawyer sits, and that's what I've done my whole career. But the other thing that is unusual about this case in front of you is that I don't think I've ever had more law on my side than I do in this case. I have lawsuits all over the United States that is exactly on point. And I'm proud to say that. Let me begin by noting in dealing with an issue that was raised first by Justice Ziegler and then by Justice Gableman, that's the issue of when are reservation of rights letters sent out and what do they contain. It is, with all due respect to Ms. Lubinsky, it is absolutely wrong to say you only send out a reservation of rights letter when you do not defend the case. You send out a reservation of rights letter, and I send out, and every defense attorney, insurance defense attorney, sends out hundreds every year. You send out a reservation of rights letter when there is a potential coverage issue. You have to do that. You have to notify the insured when there is a potential coverage issue.
And what do you rely on for that statement, aside from personal practice? What case do you rely on?
Okay, if you turn to my brief, there are, and I'll give you the cases, there's a whole line of history of reservation of rights letter that I discuss in the brief, beginning at page 6, talking about a case called Hickey versus Wisconsin Mutual, where no reservation of rights letter was sent out. Turn over to the next page. There's a case there called Wisconsin Transportation Company, and the quote is, under the terms of the policy in question, the defendant was obligated to defend the action. So therefore, there was no doubt that they had to defend the action. If it desired to negative any waiver of its rights by so defending, all that was necessary for it to do was to notify the defendant in that action and the plaintiff in this action that by so doing, it was not waiving any of its rights or defenses with respect to coverage or liability. And there are case after case after case, beginning at page 6 of the brief, and I can give you the names, but
I've read your brief, and I don't have it with me, but I will see it again before we discuss.
All of them say you have to notify the insured when there is a potential coverage issue. The famous case is the one Ms. Lubinsky referred to, Gruby versus Dawn, which said specifically that there are three things an insurance company should do. And I'm quoting from, well, this is before paragraph numbers. I'm quoting just above footnote 6 in my copy of it. The insurer and the insurer can enter into a non-waiver agreement. Let me back up. The Court of Appeals wrote, there are several procedures insurers can use to raise the coverage issue and thus retain the right to challenge coverage. Notice it doesn't talk about if they want to defend or not defend. We all have a duty to defend most of these cases. The issue is, do we want to reserve the right to challenge coverage? And the three things that the insurer can do, you can enter into a non-waiver agreement, but the court says that's rarely done. Alternatively, the insurer can request a bifurcated trial and a declaratory judgment. Or three, in addition, the insurer could give the insured notice of intent to reserve rights. When a reservation of rights is made, the insured can pursue his own defense, not subject to the control of the insurer, but the insurer still would be liable for legal fees incurred.
Mr. Moore, in this case, the insurance company has a duty, which everybody recognizes, to indemnify for certain damages, right?
Right.
The insurance company recognizes, and you agree, that they cover the liability, the general liability issue.
It is a general liability policy, right. So yes, there is coverage.
So there's coverage here. What you're fighting about is how much you're going to pay as to which items of damages. Now, would you have a reservation letter where the damages are $1 million, but your coverage is only $500,000?
Yes.
Would you issue a reservation of rights letter?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's
Absolutely.
What I'm asking you. So your view is, because I just want to make sure that when we're talking about the issue of waiver and estoppel of defenses and coverage under the policy, we're talking about how much damages and for what particular item. So you'd issue a reservation of rights that we're not waiving our right, that we're only liable for $500,000.
Absolutely correct. Anytime there's a potential coverage issue, and I regard limits of liability
That's
as a potential coverage issue, I and most attorneys I know issue a reservation of rights letter.
Okay. So your position here is they should have issued a reservation of rights saying, this policy, we're not waiving the issue, that this policy does not cover, and then list the items that might be in dispute, or the insurance policy provision that excludes certain elements of
right.
coverage. Okay.
What I was going to say is Justice Ziegler asked what goes into a reservation of rights letter, and here's what goes into it. Ms. Lubinsky was correct. You've been sued by so-and-so. The claims are such and such. Your policy of insurance from such and such company contains certain exclusions. Those exclusions are as follows. it may be that the claims asserted in this case for wage loss are not covered by reason of exclusion C. We just want you to know that. We don't know what the facts are, but there may be an issue as to that. It may be that if your conduct was intentional, you will not be covered because of exclusion so-and-so. The insurance company must notify the insured of any potential coverage issue that it knows of at the time the lawsuit is raised. And that allows the insured to decide, do I need my own attorney because these are not covered, or can I just rely on the insurance company? So when I write a reservation of rights letter, when most attorneys write them, it says, there are claims here that may not be covered because of these provisions in the policy. And I could go on in construction cases. This may not be an occurrence. Or
well, sir, do you know of any case that parses things as you are parsing them, where there is coverage for some of the claims, but not coverage for some other claims that are made in the complaint?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your
question. Do you know of a case that is on point in Wisconsin where it says that though there is coverage for certain items under the policy, other items are not covered, and therefore you must issue a reservation of rights as you pick up the defense for that case?
No, but all the cases talk about if the insurance company wants to preserve its coverage defenses, they must notify the insured of those defenses. And so it follows ipso facto to me that the insurance company has to identify which coverage defenses it wants to preserve.
But, you know, if we change the policy, go along with your argument, which I don't know what the court will do, but if we do, then essentially we're creating a contract term that was not bargained for or paid for in this policy. And also I'm wondering what effect that has on other contract law in the state of Wisconsin. Can we create terms of a contract that the party didn't agree to by estoppel and waiver if we do it here, or just is this limited to insurance policies?
With all due respect, this court has done that same thing many times. If we do not, if an insurance company does not provide defense to an insured when a case is on appeal, the insurance company loses its right to rely on coverage arguments. That's
right, but there's a contractual obligation to provide the defense. We're not there.
I'm talking about a case where a court has already ruled that an insurance company does not have to provide a defense. In the Elliott case, a case unfortunately which I handled, when we didn't provide a defense to an insured while we were challenging coverage, we ended up having to pay attorney's fees. That wasn't in the contract, and the court ordered that we had to do that. Coverage defenses are lost, attorney's fees are paid, policies are reformed all the time. But all I'm saying is this is a natural consequence of a failure to follow an absolutely clear rule. This isn't a new rule that we're asking this court to establish, contrary to what they said. This is a rule that's been around for about 100 years, that they must issue a reservation of rights letter. And they
How do you line that up with Shannon?
I'm sorry?
How do you line that up with our decision in Shannon?
The Shannon case, there was a reservation of rights letter issued, by the way, in Shannon. That's one big difference, first of all. Shannon doesn't, at least the issue never came up of this exception to the general rule announced in Shannon that is, as I view it, almost universal around the country, that when an insurance company does what this one did, the general rule, there's an exception for that. Shannon didn't have any prejudice. The family exclusion clause, after the reservation of rights letter was issued, the family exclusion clause was asserted in time and there was no prejudice. Here there is. The district lost the case. The district lost the opportunity to even settle this case because it had assumed that everything was covered. And by the way, Ms. Lubinsky pointed out to this court that there was no positive representation of coverage. There is. If you look at record item 83, it's the affidavit of Jerome Dudzik, the business administrator of the district. He, in his affidavit, indicates that the insurance company told them this would be covered if they used one of the insurance company's approved attorneys.
What's this?
Sorry?
You said this will be covered. What's this?
The Don Maxwell suit.
Pardon me?
The Don Maxwell suit.
All the damages.
There was no indication ever to the district that there was anything that was not covered. They never told the district there was any item of damage that would not be covered. And the district was affirmatively told, according to the Dudzik affidavit, it would be covered. All you have to use is one of our approved attorneys, which the district did. That's the prejudice to the district. They relied on the fact that there was nothing indicated to them that there was nothing that wasn't going to be covered. They went on for months on this case until the case was lost. Then 2 months later, in some correspondence I had with the insurance company, they, in passing, said, oh, by the way, we're not paying for this. That's the first time they ever told us that.
But, Counselor, if they had issued a reservation of rights and the lawsuit ended up in the same place, the district would still have to pay the same money. I don't see how there's prejudice because the lawsuit was lost. That seems to be what the facts and the law provided for. So the reservation of rights, I don't see how that gives you prejudice. I think it's just
we would have defended the with all due respect, we would have defended the case ourselves. It was in my hands to defend it. And the insurance company came to the district and said, and this is in the record, if you let us defend it using one of our attorneys, we would not have done that. That's also in the Dudzik affidavit. The defense would have been kept. I would have done it. And I honestly think we should not have lost that case. I'm sorry, that may sound egotistical, but I don't think
we
should
have lost that. Well, and that's, as co-counsel or opposing counsel suggests, that's a question of fact about whether the case was properly litigated by the attorney. But didn't the policy provide for the insurance companies having exclusive control of the case if they provided a defense and paid for an attorney?
So, absolutely. That's okay.
So the district could have hired their own attorney and waived their right to a defense if they wanted to, couldn't they?
Of course we could have. Of course we could have. But there was and had the insurance company said this, and this is not covered in our opinion, then the school district probably would have said, thank you very much, but we're going to use our own attorney in this case. But they didn't do that. And if the insurance company had said this and this and this is not covered, we might have settled those non-covered claims and let them litigate the covered ones. But we lost that opportunity as well because we didn't find out until after the case was lost.
So your prejudice was failing to settle.
I'm sorry?
So your prejudice was that had you known you'd be personally, I don't mean personally, but a liable, the board would be liable, you might have settled at a lower number because you'd have to pay rather than the insurance company.
You might have not wanted to take the chance on things that weren't
covered
by insurance.
That's at least one prejudice.
Exactly. The other one is we could have put on a different defense than was put on.
Could have tried to move damages from one area to another area or persuaded them that, so that you got the damages into that area where the insurance company would pay rather than damages that the insurance company wouldn't pay. That is not unusual in liability cases.
Right.
So, I'm sorry. Quick question. Just to be clear, there would have been two lawyers then. You would have defended on the wage loss only, and the insurance company would have defended on everything else, or would the district have assumed liability for the entire lawsuit saying, we don't want your coverage?
If the insurance company issues a reservation of rights letter, Groovy versus Dawn says that the insured then can go out and get its own attorney. And the question then would be, to what extent? I would be co-counsel with the insurance company's attorney on the case, because parts of it we would have been informed were not covered. And therefore, the district has to have its own attorney on those claims that are not covered, at least. Whether we took over the whole case or not, I don't know. Probably we would have, but that's speculation, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Mr. Moore, you're familiar with Arnold Anderson's treatise on Wisconsin insurance law?
If you're going to quote that against me, I'm going to get upset.
Yes, I am. If this is a black and white principle, what does Arnold Anderson have to say about it?
He talks about the principle, this line of cases that I'm espousing is not one of creating insurance coverage by waiver or estoppel. In fact, I talked to him about this right at the outset of the case. He says it is in terms of prejudice. That's why these cases are decided the way they are, the ones I'm espousing, is because the insured has been prejudiced by the conduct of the insurance company. And that is not, we're not creating language, we're just trying to prevent the prejudice to the insured. That's what he says, and I apologize, I haven't brought his treatise with me, but that's, I remember talking to him about it, and I remember looking in that section of his book dealing with that, where he talks about the Powell's case.
Well, does that require some finding of prejudice?
I don't know what more prejudice you could have in this case than we lost. I mean, that is the ultimate prejudice. In most of the cases we cited from other jurisdictions, the courts don't even consider prejudice. They say, when an insurance company does this, it is prejudicial as a matter of law. They don't even require any proof. It's automatically assumed. Here, I think you ought to adopt that rule, but we don't even need to because the prejudice is so obvious, in my opinion. We lost the case. We lost the case, and we weren't even told that there wasn't coverage for it until 2 months after their attorney lost the case.
But, Counselor, if you lost the case after a reservation of rights letter was issued, you'd be in the same spot. So I don't see how losing the case is per se prejudice.
Well, first of all, somebody else would have been in there defending it. I honestly, I respectfully submit
I know,
it wasn't
you think
defended
that you could
properly.
Have, right, and
that's
you may
one.
Be right. You may
Number
be right.
two, we might have been able to work out some sort of a settlement of those things that weren't covered and let go the things that were covered. There were any number of things, but frankly, I honestly believe the case would not have been lost. I really do.
Counsel.
And I know that you may disagree with that, but
no,
that's my honest opinion.
I don't
opinion.
Have any view of that at all. That's a trial court matter, I think.
There were a number of summary judgment motions filed that were not, in my opinion, properly opposed. And I'm not here making an argument that the attorney was incompetent. I'm not saying that.
Sure.
I'm just saying I would have done it differently, and I would have put a lot more evidence in the record than he did.
Counsel, I'd like
Thank
to
you.
Come back to the issue concerning the reservation of rights letter. I think it's an interesting issue. I think it's one that's going to be relevant to this case. And I'm aware of the cases that you cited in your brief. I've read it. And primary among them is Grubbe. And pages 46 and 47 of that opinion do list out the three alternatives as you've described them. But it prefaces its discussion of the three alternatives on the facts not only present in that case, but also in the professional office buildings case. And what the court said there is that the issue in the instant case, whether an insurer who breached its duty to defend, now my eye was certainly caught by that, breached its duty to defend, can later contest coverage, is identical to the issue in professional office buildings. Now, you quoted the next paragraph, starting with rather than raising the issue in court. You quoted that part, but I didn't see this prefatory section in your brief. And I wonder, because then, directly after its recitation of the factual issue, which is at odds, it seems to me, it seems clear, that it's at odds. Here, there's no allegation that the insurer breached its duty to defend. They defended. They provided a defense. They didn't argue. They didn't sit back. But how do you, are there any cases that you're aware of that would require, now I know it's common practice. I know that. And is it the preferred method? Obviously it would be. But purely as a legal question, as a matter of law, is there currently right now a case on point that would require where the insurance provider, insurance company does not contest coverage, does not breach its duty, I'm sorry, contest its duty to provide a defense or breach that duty, is there a legal requirement that they follow one of the three alternatives suggested in Grubbe or simply provide the reservation of rights letter?
If you're asking is there a case in Wisconsin since Grubbe, the answer is no. If there's a case in Wisconsin before Grubbe, there are plenty. There's the Powell's case. There's the Caring case.
Well, Powell's, we've already discussed Powell's. Powell's is the owner of that cheese company who insured his personal Buick, and he was having the discussion, as I read the case, with the insurance agent. He said, well, as long as I'm insuring the business, can you put my Buick in there? And there was no dispute whatsoever that that was the agreement reached between the insurance company and the owner of that factory. And then when he got in an accident, the court, to my eye, said, hey, that was the agreement of the parties, and due to a clerical error, I think that was the insurance company's explanation, it was a clerical error, that the Buick wasn't included, we're going to reform this contract to reflect the intent of the parties. So I don't know how you can rely on Powell's.
Well, the Court of Appeals relied on Powell's.
I understand that.
So I'm not alone in my argument here.
Well, that's good.
If you look on its face at Powell's, Powell's was, case got tried, judgment was rendered, the insured lost, the insurance company said we're not going to pay for the following reason. And if you read this court's decision in there, it doesn't talk so much about reformation as it talks about the fundamental unfairness. At least that's how I read it. And that's, I think, how the Court of Appeals read it. But there are cases, there's a Caring case in the federal court, Judge Evans, that whole string of cases I mentioned to Justice Rogensack, beginning at page 6, that says if you want to preserve a policy defense, you have to send a reservation of rights letter. All those cases are quoted in the brief. And the cases from around the country all deal with this issue directly, the ones that we've cited in the brief.
And they those cases say, that you cite are on all fours with the facts of the present matter.
I can't tell you that they're on all fours. No, I'm talking about the proposition that you asked, is there a requirement that a reservation of rights be issued to preserve it? Yes, there is.
And I understand your interpretation of those
cases. Mr. Moore, if I'm the insurance company, I am asked to defend a lawsuit, I may or may not think there's coverage. That'll be...
Justice Ziegler, we can't hear you. The council is having trouble hearing you, and I'm having trouble hearing you. Would you speak into your microphone and slow down, please?
Thank you, Chief. If I'm the insurance company and I get a lawsuit from my client, they say they want me to defend, and I don't know if there's coverage or not. The obligation to issue the reservation of rights letter comes at the beginning, right?
Correct.
Okay. So is it true that regardless of how a lawsuit might change over time. Sometimes claims are added. Sometimes discovery means that a claim that you thought didn't exist does exist, or damages are sought that aren't. Oftentimes damage provisions are pretty open-ended. So you don't exactly know under notice pleading there will or won't be coverage. Does the insurance company have an ongoing duty to supplement the reservation of rights letter so that at any given time during the course of a lawsuit, the other party says, oh, okay, there's no coverage for this kind of damage. I now want to hire my own lawyer.
The answer is yes. The answer is yes. When an insurance company may not perceive at the beginning of the lawsuit that there are coverage issues, it may simply not know that somebody acted intentionally or that this is the claim being made. And that's why we phrase it, if it is alleged as this, there may not be coverage. But later on, if there is an amendment to the complaint or if discovery reveals something that people didn't know, yes, if it's going to affect coverage, if there's a potential coverage issue, if they want to preserve that issue, if they want to be able to argue it later, they have to send a reservation of rights letter. We do it all the time.
Aren't you really relying on, and the Court of Appeals basically relying on an estoppel argument? Or a waiver argument. And that is that the insurance company knows its policy. Right? It wrote it. It's held to know it. It knows that it's not going to cover, let's just say here, attorney fees. It then, under the policy, takes exclusive control of the defense under the terms of the policy. Never advises its insured that it has doubts about coverage of attorney fees, which may be awarded. So it, in effect, by its conduct of taking over exclusive jurisdiction, it lulls the insured not to take care of its own interests because the insured is relying on you to take care of its interests. And the argument then is that the insurance company, by its conduct, is stopped to assert the defense of no coverage, right? That's the essence.
That is the essence of it, yes.
So the company has to give a reservation of rights letter or not. If the court said they did, that shows a waiver or estoppel more clearly, but you're basing it on conduct, which is a general principle of contract, namely that the conduct of the parties can change the terms of the contract.
There are consequences that flow from the conduct of the parties.
That's how I phrase it. And the issue then becomes whether it's prejudicial, whether that's the end of the case. The insured wins, or whether the consequences are of harm or not harm, and who has to make that burden of proof. And another issue that's raised here is whether this is a retroactive or prospective
Well, I would say it has to be retroactive. This has been such a clear rule throughout the United States and in Wisconsin for so many years.
It doesn't really matter to you whether it's retroactive or prospective as long as it covers your client.
Well, that would be my job to argue for that, I would think.
Okay.
But, yes, I mean, if you're going to say, well, it doesn't apply in this case but applies from now on, I would be a little disappointed with that because I think this is clear. I mean, literally, we as insurance attorneys issue reservation of rights letters all the time. This is nothing new. One other point, I've got the yellow light, and someone else had talked about, and I apologize for not remembering, this issue of fairness. And it may have been you, Chief Justice, that who should bear the responsibility when there's an ambiguity? Or maybe it was you, Justice Bradley, that talked about that. And we talked about, yes, it was you, because you quoted from Justice Steinmetz in the Town Realty case. And I was reminded by the last quotation I think I have in my brief on page 40, where it talks about the same thing. It's in a different context entirely, but it says insurance companies have this duty to their insureds, and it was described in this case. In fact, it was the Prosser case. This duty that they owe to insureds, similar to a fiduciary duty. And it says, however, insurers have had a fiduciary duty to their insureds since at least 1931 with this court's decision in Hilker. In sum, we conclude that as part of its fiduciary duty to its insured, an insurer has a duty to clarify any ambiguity in a settlement offer it receives. Now, that's a settlement offer. Your case, Town Realty, was a tender. But the principle is the same, and the principle here is in coverage. If the insurance company, as the company that knows its policy, it gets sued a lot, knows it has a coverage defense, it has a duty to tell its insured that. There's no harm to the insured or the relationship. That's all we asked for in this case, was to simply say, okay, we're not going to cover this. We could have then made an intelligent decision whether to get involved in that case, to settle it, to do anything else. We didn't know that. They didn't treat this insured fairly. They didn't treat it as a fiduciary would. They didn't let it know that there were things that were not going to be covered, at least in their opinion, not going to be covered. And as a result, we sat back and let them take exclusive control over that lawsuit, to run with it, and then to lose it. And I, Justice Rogenczak, I know we disagree on this, but I honestly believe the case would not have been wrong. I don't disagree with you at all, counsel.
I mean, you may be 100% right. I don't have any view of that at all, and that really wasn't something that was argued. I think the only way it came up is opposing counsel said, if you're looking at prejudice as losing the lawsuit, then that has to go to the trial court to determine if, in fact, the lawsuit, there was something, you know, inappropriately done, so the lawsuit was lost.
Yeah, I don't want to have to go back to the trial court because then I have to retry the whole thing. If we had put in this evidence, would the result have been different or not? The point is we lost, and I can't imagine. Not only do I think I have lots of law on my side, I think I have lots of equity on my side as well, because I can't imagine more prejudice to an insured than actually losing the case and then 2 months later being told, oh, by the way, we're not paying for this. So that's my time. Unless there are any other questions, I want to thank you.
Yes. Could I ask, there's a reference here in the Court of Appeals decision to the fact that you were not on CIC's approved list. Now, of course, we know you and respect you very much. What are the dynamics here? Does an insurance company settle on a group of attorneys and get some special rate from them? Why you certainly weren't on an improved list because you're not competent.
Well, thank you. The way this works typically in the insurance industry is that insurance companies have a group of attorneys that they have confidence in that will do the job at a reasonable cost. Not that they get a special rate, but that they know enough of what they're doing so that they know when they get charged it isn't going to be excessive. Because the insurance company continues to send cases to them, they continue to want to make sure the insurance company thinks they're delivering good value for their services. So all insurance companies that I know of have approved attorneys within different parts of the state and in different states that they go to when they get sued. And I'm not on CIC's list, but I've never asked to be on it either. I'm not criticizing them for not putting me on it. But that is how it works. It's a close relationship that exists between the insurance company and the attorneys. And the attorneys have to be independent. There's no doubt about it. I'm not claiming that they were in the pocket of the insurance company in this case. They have a list of attorneys. When when we had trouble with the attorney originally appointed by the insurance company, we asked them to appoint another attorney, which they did. They put another attorney from their approved list on the case. That's much later in the progress of the lawsuit. But that's the dynamic of how this works with insurance companies and attorneys. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
I'm sorry. What about the Watertown Tire Recyclers case that's printed?
I'm getting so old my hearing is.
Sorry, because I have some issues about laryngitis, so I will speak up and speak more slowly, too. In the Ms. Lobinski's brief, her reply brief, we have the Watertown Tire Recyclers, and paragraph 5, which is the holding, the conclusion says equitable estoppel doesn't apply to exclusionary clauses. Says that you have to show a party's conduct unambiguously indicated a shared intent to modify the policy. What application does that have to this case? And this is not recommended for publication in the official report, so it could only be, and I didn't check to see whether it was published, so it would be persuasive authority because it is a three-judge opinion. I assume that's why it's cited.
That was a pretty straightforward application. I don't believe it's been published, and I don't believe, therefore, it is precedent. But that's a fairly straightforward application of the general rule that I'm not saying the general rule should be abolished, that we don't normally create coverage by waiver or estoppel. I'm saying this case presents a very well-recognized exception to that general rule. This, the Watertown Tire case, really had nothing to do with prejudice. It really had nothing to do with failure to issue a reservation of rights letter. It is just a recitation of that general rule, which is already in our jurisprudence in Shannon and in Utica Mutual.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Lubinsky.
Thank you. I guess I'll leave off where Attorney Moore ended, which is that there are no exceptions recognized in Wisconsin law to that rule other than forfeiture clauses. There's not a single case in which the court, any Wisconsin court, has found an exception to the non-waiver, non-estoppel rule in a coverage case.
Couch on Insurance, which is one of the treatises that we often look to, recognizes that general rule that you're talking about and that Mr. Moore was just talking about. I'm reading from page 202, colon 54, and it says, although the doctrine of waiver and estoppel cannot generally be used to create insurance coverage where none exists under the terms of the policy, an exception to the general rule exists when a liability insurer, number one, assumes the insured's defense, number two, with knowledge of facts indicating non-coverage, number three, and without declaring a reservation of rights or obtaining a non-waiver agreement. And they say in such circumstances in which all policy defenses, including those of non-coverage, are waived. And so they're saying this is the general rule, and of course they cite a number of jurisdictions that say that when you have knowledge of facts indicating non-coverage and you don't declare a reservation of rights or obtain a waiver, non-waiver, then your defense of non-coverage is waived. Your argument is, but that general, that exception to the general rule doesn't apply in Wisconsin. Is that correct?
My argument is it's never been applied in Wisconsin. I do not dispute that the Couch Treatise that you cited says what it says. But the Couch Treatise at section 202:69 also says that in those instances, an insured must so show prejudice that results from the insured's conduct and to the defendant of the insured, quote, unless a conflict of interest or other harm is clear and unmistakable. And so the very treatise that is relied on to find an exception to the general rule says, yeah, but you got to show prejudice, unless there's a conflict of interest. In this case, there's no claim that there's a conflict of interest, or the harm is clear and unmistakable. Attorney Moore has argued that the harm is clear and unmistakable because the district lost the case. I would point out one fact. It's a fact of record, and that is that Attorney Moore, who contends that if only we would have been told all these things in a reservation of rights letter, I would have defended the case. He was defending the case. He is, you can go to CCAP, he is counsel of record until after the trial court grants summary judgment to Ms. Maxwell, declaring that there was not just cause under the contract. And I would submit Justin Rogensack has it right. Those are issues for remand. Attorney Moore has raised the issue, wait a minute, I put in an affidavit from my guy saying that, hey, when I talked to Brian Nee, he said you'd be covered. Chief Justice, you asked, well, what does that mean? And there was a dialogue about that. I will also point out that Brian Nee in an affidavit contests that. Those are issues, though, for the trial court to resolve, not this court. And so any suggestion that there's ipso facto, that there's harm clear and unmistakable, such that this court should not remand, is belied by the record. The record in this case is very clear. The briefs that Attorney Moore claims were inartfully drafted, the record also shows that Attorney Moore was presented with copies of every single brief. We've got that in our facts. Now, I'm not suggesting you should resolve prejudice, that this court should resolve that. I believe that is a remand issue. And I understand Attorney Moore's arguments. I think he understands mine, but those are for the trial court to resolve.
Well, what else should be decided by the trial court? I hear you saying that the insurance company didn't have exclusive control over the defense of this case. Is that right? Is that your argument?
No, that's not my argument. I'm not arguing that the insurer didn't, by hiring counsel, have control over the defense. The issue then would become, what does that mean? Well, I do insurance defense all the time, and Attorney Moore is right. We have ethical obligations, and those obligations flow to the insured. And so the obligation that Attorney Levy, who was not counsel for the insurer, we got to correct that in this court's decision. He was only counsel for the district. I see my time is up. May I briefly end?
Yes.
We need to correct that in the record. But in any event, the issue will become what harm, as some of the justices have noted, what harm befell the district by being told what was already in the policy. And the argument I hear is that, well, maybe we would have done things differently. I'm pretty sure I'm going to win that argument on remand, because I think the record is clear. Attorney Moore was involved. He litigated the case. I would envision lots of evidence about involvement of the selection of counsel, and I think the trial court's best to resolve those issues.
May I ask, I honestly was somewhat taken aback that neither side quoted Arnold Anderson. What's your take on that?
Arnie Anderson, I meant to do that in my rebuttal. At the time the third-party complaint was filed, Arnie Anderson said nothing about the exception. After this third-party complaint got filed, Arnie Anderson's treatise changed. And that's a fact. You can look back at how the treatise was changed after this lawsuit was filed.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Lubinsky, and thank you, Mr. Moore, for your briefs and your argument on this case. And insurance policies are one of the most frequent contracts in this case and across the country. So we have a lot of insurance contract cases. Thank you. And that concludes our argument on 09-AP-2176, Dawn L. Maxwell versus Hartford Union High School District. As counsel leave, I want to welcome the students who have arrived from Central Wisconsin Christian School. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. I announced before you came that you are part of our Court with Class program, in that you will meet with a justice of this court after our second case, and you're going to meet with the assigned justice today, Justice Pat Robinson. So thank you for coming. You may be seated.
They're going to leave.
Pardon me?
They're leaving.
Oh, they're leaving. You don't have to sit down and leave. You can stand and leave. And the court will be in recess for a few moments while another group of school classmates will arrive. The court is in recess.